One of the most searing images from the past year will most certainly be the picture of that little boy, the one from Syria whose body washed ashore face down in Turkey. That image brought the refugee crisis home for a lot of people, and in fact, it sent one woman, a nurse and a mother named Jennifer Silverstone from Massachusetts, to do something. This month, Silverstone set out for Europe. She figured her nursing skills could be used at the refugee camps in Calais and Dunkirk, France, where migrants have gathered as they try to sneak into the United Kingdom. Silverstone connected with a friend in the UK who had an SUV that they'd load up with supplies, and then she booked her flight.
Then I sent a message out through Facebook to my community and said, if anybody wants to go, if you know Arabic, this is what I'm doing, these are the dates. And through a friend, I got connected to two other people. Heidi Sleemans from Wayland. She's a mom and a wife, and she's done a lot of humanitarian work with Kids for Peace and Global Smile. She also speaks Arabic, so that was a bonus. And then Sammy Abdullah, he works for Partners. He's in the Boston area, and he's a father. So he signed up, too.
So you get there. You arrive at Calais, and you see this refugee camp. Now, this is right on the English Channel, just over the border. Just on the other side of the water is the United Kingdom, where so many of these refugees are desperate to get. Mm-hmm. And you have heard all this stuff on the news about how bad it is. But was it as bad as you thought it would be when you got there?
It's a good question. I think I tried to brace myself for what I was going to see. Before I was in endoscopy nursing, I was in the NICU, the neonatal intensive care, and saw a lot of difficult stuff. So I thought, I'm strong. I can take it, you know? And what you see when you walk in there is just unimaginable. It's horrible.
Well, how bad? I mean, the injuries are unique because these are migrants trying to get on trains and onto trucks, and they're trying to get through barbed wire, so they have maybe cuts on their hands. These are unique types of injuries that I'm sure you're seeing.
They are. I haven't really come across them until I came to Calais. So we would get there early in the morning to set up the caravan before anyone was out. All of a sudden, you'd see crowds of men running, yelling. And I said, what is going on out there? And they said, oh, well, they're trying to slow down the morning traffic going through the tunnel. Someone had thrown a tree over the fence to slow traffic down so that everybody could jump on the lorries. They would come back. Some of them made it, but some of them would come back with, they got hit on the head, tear gassed. It was so crazy to see.
Were you working all day trying to put these people back together?
Yep, we would work all day with one caravan. It was Sammy would stand outside and queue mostly men and boys up. Then Heidi would translate for me, and then I would give them care. You know, stitches wouldn't be something I would do, but if I could makeshift stitches, that would be great. Because even though we were giving them care, a lot of them were much sicker than I could have helped. And the local hospitals were turning them away. They wouldn't see them. So the closest care they had was to Belgium. So they'd have to figure a way to get to Belgium.
Did you have the supplies that you need? Because I've been reading about the donations that these camps have been getting. And so you might get a truckload of teddy bears for a camp full of young men who have no need for a teddy bears. I mean, did you have what you needed?
Well, we brought a lot of stuff from the U.S. with us. And there are two warehouses that service Dunkirk and Calais, but it's all volunteer again. So you might have 40 pairs of boots in the warehouse, but no one to take them to the people. Their basic needs aren't being met. So every day is, you know, food, water is a challenge for them, shelter.
Yeah.
They all live in tents.
You say this was a camp run by volunteers, and I know there are police in the area because they were clashing with some of the migrants as they tried to get on or off these trucks or these trains. But did you get a sense at all that there was anyone in charge there?
Absolutely not. I think Calais is running, it's governing its own self, all these people. The police come in, but it's only to antagonize. For instance, they ran over this refugee's leg while he was sleeping for no reason. And so he came to me and I put a little lace bandage on it. But it's things like that. If they get too close to the fence in the morning, they'll get tear gas. And then randomly at night, the closest to the fence is a lot of families. And they would just throw tear gas into that area and smoke all these people out in the middle of the night. It was just so bizarre.
How long were you there?
I was there 5 days.
Probably could have spent the entire year there.
Yeah. Well, we were in Calais for 3 days, and then we drove 20 minutes north up to Dunkirk, the newest one, and it's mainly all Kurds. And it's a lot of women and children. It was more awful than Calais. It's very unorganized. They brought in some porta potties, but they don't service them regularly, so everything is overflowing. There's about 2 inches of mud and sewage mixed in together.
Did you ever get the sense that, like, you were not in the Western world?
Yes, I could not. You could have pinched me. I just couldn't believe that this was in France. Our hotel that we stayed at was about 5 minutes away from Calais refugee camp, and you would never know what was going on. There's, you know, Christmas, they're making ice sculptures in the park, families are running around laughing, and I'm going, this is such a weird juxtaposition that this is actually going on here.
Now that you're home, is there a moment that you look back on that sort of strikes you as the moment that made your time there?
Yes, there are several, but there's two that really stand out in my mind. And the first one is when we first entered into Dunkirk, I saw this woman holding this baby, this little girl in a snowsuit. And I was giving out baby carriers. That was one of the things that I had brought with me. So I fitted the baby carrier on her, and she was just the sweetest woman. And she thanked me profusely, hugged, kissed. So we go through the rest of the camp, and we're going tent to tent because that's kind of how you have to do it at Dunkirk. A couple hours later, we're leaving, and the mother and the grandmother had this baby taken out of the carrier, and they were holding her up to me saying, "America, America, we want you to take her." They were serious. They wanted me to take this baby. And my heart just broke when I thought that they would risk separation from this. She couldn't have been more than 10 months old.
And you're a mother, so you know what that means.
Yes, that's how desperate it is. I mean, it's really awful. I mean, it's hard not to think about stuff like that. It affects you deeply, you know? The other story that really impacted me was as soon as I walked into Dunkirk, I saw the most beautiful boy with these big brown eyes, like my sons have big brown eyes. And I started to walk up to him, and he had on a coat that was soaking wet. And his mom was with him, and I said, "Coat?" And she was like, "Yes, please." So I had packed two of my son's coats that they had outgrown, and I put both of them on him and zipped them up. And, you know, I asked if I could take their picture, and their mother was like, "Yes." And I walked away from that, and I just lost it. The thought that I never knew when I purchased those coats that they would have such a big job to do after my own kids had grown out of them. So I hold that memory dearly in my heart.
Jennifer Silverstone is a nurse from Massachusetts, just back from a volunteer trip from the refugee camps in Calais, France. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So what happens to the thousands of people living in these camps? Dimitri Papadimitriou is president emeritus of the Migration Policy Institute, and I asked him what life would be like in the UK if these migrants were able to get across the English Channel.
Even if they cross into Britain, the UK will try to determine whether they could qualify for protection. The standards are going to be very tough. And for many of these people who will not qualify, they're going to be removed. So they've spent all this money. They have suffered. God only knows what kinds of circumstances and depravities over in the past 6 years, 6 months or a year, however long they've been on the move, just to be sent back. That tells you something both about the determination of the people who want to get there, the determination of the Brits not to allow people who do not fully and squarely qualify as refugees to stay in the UK, and the sort of false expectations that people may have about what happens to them at the end of the line.
Mm-hmm. Well, the UK and France in this situation are providing more security in the area. They're providing more police, more fencing. But are they responding with similar resources to deal with the humanitarian crisis?
None whatsoever. You know, as far as they're concerned, they're trying to treat the phenomenon, the situation there on the ground, as a security situation. They're trying to make sure that traffic and commerce, et cetera, continues to flow back and forth. And they're staying outside of the camps because they do not want to create expectations on the part of the people who are in those horrible camps. And they do not want to have those camps become permanent. But in reality, everybody bears some responsibility for how things are in these places. France, well, these people should not have been able to cross all the way through France to make it to Calais or to Dunkirk. Somebody is not minding the store at all. Mm. And if you want to go even further down, Italy is not minding the store. This isn't going to end well. And the only way that these camps are going to sort of slowly, you know, grow down, as it were, become smaller, is once it settles in that people will not make it in, period.
That was Dimitri Papadimitriou, President Emeritus of the Migration Policy Institute. You're listening to Here and Now.